Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Ellen Roberts, Director of the Senior Mentor Program in the University of North Carolina's Division of Geriatric Medicine, along with Will Plattner, a longtime volunteer mentor, about working together to improve the care of an aging population. This is such an important conversation because we know that the number of people over the age of 80 and 90 and even 100 is growing exponentially in the United States. And yet the number of providers who care for aging patients seems to be less. How we develop students and the next generation who really care about geriatrics passionately and want to be able to care for adult populations, that's a really important conversation that we're going to have. First, though, we have some research that matters. And this very first one is one that perhaps I have fallen victim to and can really strive to do better. And it's the terms that we use to describe our mentees. We're going to be talking about mentorship in the conversation with our senior adults, but this is about the mentees, the learners, and particularly, let's say, medical students. When they do rotations with us, they're frequently coming with us for a rotation 4 to 6 weeks. They may be with us every day. They may be shadowing providers. They may be seeing patients with us and presenting to us. And at the very end of that period of time, we do evaluations of the students. Some authors from the University of San Francisco, California, published an article in the Journal of General Internal Medicine, which said, do the evaluations that I and maybe my colleagues do differ by the gender and the minority status of the students? So specifically, do I write different things, whether or not the medical student is a male or a female or African-American or non-African-American? And do I then perhaps implicitly have some bias of how I describe and maybe evaluate them? I don't know if the research completely answers that, but it's really quite interesting because they actually looked at over 9 years from 2006 to 2015, both in California and San Francisco and at Brown University, had over 90,000 narrative evaluations of third-year students. That alone, I think, is impressive, understanding the evaluation and collecting it orally. And they were really to say, is it on the behavior of the student or the competencies, the skills that they show or don't show that are relevant, but that a lot of times people, when they were evaluating him, used a kind of a personal description, and it was really striking by gender, and it really could impact on their evaluation. So, for instance, in 2/3 of the words that the evaluators used differed by gender on the personal attributes, half of which were more likely to be used to describe women. So the word pleasant was associated with getting a passing grade. The word energetic, cheerful, lovely, and wonderful and fabulous associated with honors grades. And those were with women. For men, it was respectful and considerate. While good was associated with earning passing grades, and humble was more common among those who are in honors grades. We're clearly having some bias by the gender there and influencing how we are writing about them. When we were talking about a minority status, we also tended to have certain words that we used. So we were more likely to use present, open, and nice to describe the minority students with passing grades versus words like enthusiastic, sharp, and bright for the non-minority students, and mature and sophisticated for honors grades. I think what this shows us is that we tend to have biases of the types of words we use to describe people versus, I bet I wouldn't use those same words if I didn't know the gender or the minority status. I'd like to think that I'm not biased, but I think this research suggests that I need to do a better job, and we all need to do a better job of how it is we describe what it is we're witnessing even when it comes by people who we think are being non-biased. Our next research that matters is about stigma of athletes and how mental health stigma, particularly with elite athletes, may delay getting therapy. And this research in the British Journal of Sports Medicine actually looked at 52 studies covering 13,000 elite athletes from 71 sports. And this stigma of what it meant to have mental illness is really what kept these elite athletes from getting help, because it might be a sign of weakness rather than being a winner. And I think this research is that coaches, and I would say parents, really need to let our elite athletes know, those who are driven to succeed, but also that it can be a sign of strength to get help for mental illness. For ourselves, for our children, for our athletes, we need to do better ending those barriers. Our next research that matters really is about what we can do to make it our world safer for children. This is about riding a bike. 18% of parents say that their child never wears a helmet on a bike ride. I've seen this data before, and it seems like we should be getting better. But over 426,000 children visited an emergency department in 2015 due to injuries from some wheeled sports related. This was researched by Dr. Gary Fried at the University of Michigan. But they were looking at, in this particular poll of 1,300 parents who had a child ages 4 to 13. And again, so many of these parents did allow their children to ride without a helmet or to ride on a street compared to bike lanes. And yes, the younger children were more likely to wear a helmet than the older children, but these older children were only ages 11 to 13. Injuries are preventable. They're not just accidents. We'll look forward to that conversation with Dr. Fried. Our last research that matters is directly relevant to our thoughts about gun-related violence. And this is a study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association of Pediatrics, really looking at, could we prevent more childhood suicides and childhood injuries from guns if guns were properly stored, safe, with the bullets separate from the gun and locked? And they again looked over time, and this was a national survey in 2015. We know that one of three households in the United States has at least one gun. And among those households with had guns and a children at home, 20% reported storing them loaded and unlocked, which is the least safe way. Additional 50% either stored them either loaded or unlocked. So that means 7% of all children in the United States live in a house in which these one gun is stored unsafe. This has really risen dramatically since the last survey in 2002. We need to do better. We needed to give the message as providers and as society that we can prevent these accidents, we can prevent some of these suicides by simple measures. That'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Ellen Roberts, Director of the Senior Mentor Program at the University of North Carolina's Division of Geriatric Medicine, along with Will Plattner, a longtime volunteer mentor, about working together to improve the care of an aging population. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Dr. Ellen Roberts, Director of the Senior Mentor Program at the University of North Carolina's Division of Geriatric Medicine, and Will Plattner, a longtime volunteer mentor, about working together to improve the care of an aging population. Welcome to Your Health.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's great to have you both here. And before we get started, I'd really like to hear a little bit about your stories, and maybe Ellen will start with you. How did you get interested in geriatrics and working with the elderly population?
My background is public health education,
And when I was in my late 20s, I was at Dartmouth Medical School looking for a job and was offered to be the director of a program that at the time was Staying Healthy After 50. And so I got the project directorship, and that was my introduction to geriatrics. It was self-help for the older adult, and it's been in my path ever since.
And you were a young adult then.
I was very young then.
And what was it like as a first job working with people who were much older than you?
It was really fun because everyone, it was open, had a lot of stories. And as a health educator, my responsibility and path was to try to help them develop self-help plans to better their health. And so it was a lot of fun designing the program and watching them all grow and be able to improve their health.
Well, one of the things that I've learned in my career, I first started, my patients were younger. As I've gotten older, my patients have aged, and now I probably am a geriatric physician because I really take care of a very elderly population, which I really love. So I think that you grow into this. And Will, tell us about your path to the region. How did you get here? What kind of work have you done?
Sure.
What's important to you in your life?
Okay, well, my wife and I lived on Long Island. We're New Yorkers, and I worked for a bank on Long Island. And finally, the bank got too big for me, and I said, maybe it's time to move. We moved up to New Hampshire, built a beautiful little house up there, had great friends. And then our daughter moved to Raleigh, and she was having children down here. So 10 years ago, we came to Chapel Hill. At that point, we needed a doctor. So I made a few phone calls, and every time I called a doctor's office, I was told they don't accept Medicare patients. And my wife and I were getting a little bit discouraged. And after the fourth call, finally the person that answered the phone call said to me, "I'm sorry, we're not accepting Medicare patients. However, you may want to call UNC Geriatrics." He said, "My mother goes there, and she's very, very happy." We did. We were accepted. Shortly thereafter, our doctor called me once and said, "Listen, would you like to be a senior mentor to first-year medical students?" And initially, I thought, well, I don't have any medical background. I mean, what could I possibly do there? She said, no. They just want to know about you. And I said, great. Okay, sure. Let's do it.
That's wonderful, and it's so glad that you moved down here and
Absolutely.
Become part of a new community. And Ellen, we'll mention this, senior mentors, and that's really in part what we're really here to talk about today, is this idea of working and teaching generations of new medical providers and training what it is to work with seniors and to develop a love or at least respect of geriatrics. Tell us about it and how you became involved with it.
Well, initially I became involved with it with a grant from the John A. Hartford Foundation, and the goal was to develop a longitudinal program for medical students so they would have the experience of seeing the well elderly that are living independently in the community. Because at that point in time, the Hartford Foundation was concerned that the students wouldn't be interested in going into any practices that were caring for older adults because they were seeing in the hospital at the time mainly the frail, very sick older adults, and they wanted to have some kind of a program where students would be able to interact with the older adult, but see what their big patient population or mainly what their patient population would be besides the hospital patient. And that's how the program got started.
And so if we fast forward, we now have medical students in the entire class that each year develops a relationship with someone like you, Will. Is that correct?
That's correct. For a short period of time, but I wish it was longer, but I understand.
And they'll meet with you four or five times over the course of 5 or 6 months?
Semester, second uh-huh. semester of their freshman year.
What is the conversation like? Bring us in there.
Well, it gets kicked off with a luncheon in January where we're assigned two students. And the first year that I was there, I had a young man and a young woman. And I was talking to them, and they were talking to me. And just out of the blue, I said, you know, when this is finished, let's all go skydiving. And John, he looked at me and he said, Mr. Plattner, I always wanted to do that. Let's do it. And all of a sudden I said to myself, uh-oh, do I really want to do this?
Had you done skydiving previously?
Never. And I said, okay, John, I'll leave it up to you. I really didn't think I'd hear from him. But after we were finished, a month later, John calls me up. Mr. Plattner, Groupon, big deal, half price. Are you in? Sure, John. And the rest is history. And we had a great time. I don't know if I'd do it again, but we had a great time. Well, I guess I would if another student asked me.
You know, don't ask me if I want to do skydiving, Will. Because all I can say is OMG, and you can figure out what the real behind-the-scenes meaning of that. I would have just said, just kidding. Well, that's just great, though. That was great. So you're out here. You're meeting students. Tell us, Ellen, what is the goal here? Is it just for the students to form and understand what this means? Or is it also a goal of connecting seniors to something bigger than themselves?
It's both. And also, we try to develop the curriculum in relation to their introduction to clinical medicine, which is now called patient-centered care, so that what they're learning in their first year for their clinical skills, such as interviewing skills, taking social histories, learning how to interview, learning how to take blood pressures, their mentors are also assisting them and answering them and helping them. Like if they don't, most of our mentors know how to take blood pressures, but our first year medical students don't. So they're very good mentors at helping them learn their skills as well. So it's combined. Not only is it to have a better understanding of all of the, as Mr. Plattner showed us, as Will showed us, that we can have older adults skydiving, but also it's to learn about the lives of older adults as well as practice their skills.
Well, we need to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Ellen Roberts, director of the Senior Mentor Program at the University of North Carolina's Division of Geriatric Medicine, and Will Plattner, a longtime volunteer mentor, about working together to improve the care of an aging population. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Ellen Roberts at the University of North Carolina's Division of Geriatric Medicine, and Will Plattner, a longtime volunteer mentor, about the work they're doing together to improve the care of an aging population. And right before the break, Will, you had told us a pretty impressive story about skydiving with a medical student who neither of you had gone before, and you both survived another day. I'd like to know, it seems like there's all kinds of things that could happen in this relationship between a mentor and a mentee, some of which you probably don't think of as dangerous. But how, Ellen, do you structure it to ensure both learning but also safety and boundaries and respect, all these things?
Originally, how we started that was as we started asking physicians at UNC. We started first with our geriatricians and asked them, like Will said, to make recommendations from their patient population that they thought would make a good mentor. So we would have that whole full circle. If there was a problem, the students could go to their course directors in patient-centered care. or they could come to me, and then we could contact the primary care physician. So we had a whole circle. And in addition, for security, we pair the students because they do not go out with a faculty member. So they always are told to go out as a team, not by themselves, so that there's security in both of them in case there's an issue. Or if they find an issue at the house, they can report it back. So we also tell the students that they are not allowed to ride in the mentors' cars if they're going somewhere besides their home, and vice versa, that while they are actually doing their program, they are to drive separately. If they're meeting each other, they have to meet each other separately. When they have time off or it's the end of the program, then that's their own personal lives. If they've made relationship and become friends, then that is another level.
Yeah, and I think many times that happens and many times it may not happen. I'm wondering from your perspective, Will, if you could share with us maybe another experience you've had in the mentoring aspect, something that's been really meaningful to you, unexpected.
There are several, but for me, meeting these young folks, and they're highly intelligent, I could tell right away, and they had such enthusiasm and zeal. They were going to be a doctor, you know, they were going to be doctors, and you could tell it kind of rubbed off on me. I wish I was going to be a doctor, but obviously that's not going to happen. But I think just the banter back and forth. But each time I met with a different group, it was like a mini examination, mental and physical, for me.
So you benefited.
Absolutely.
And you gave. And that's the kind of the epitome of this mentor-mentee. I'm thinking of a mentee I have right now. And I'm really thinking about her career and how we really move that along. But then also, you know, I talk about what's happening in their lives, because you got to understand both those things in order to help them.
Absolutely.
Have you maintained any relationships with any students since you've mentored them, seen any of them even graduate?
The first two that I had, my wife and I went over for a cookout, and that's when we showed the video, the skydiving video. And then since then, I kind of followed them. John, I believe he's in emergency medicine, and I believe Abby is involved in women's health. But no, we kind of drifted away. But I enjoyed it while I could.
Yeah. And you're proud of where they're at and know that you contributed.
Absolutely.
To that.
Absolutely.
You know, Ellen, it seems that this program is designed to influence outcomes. You're really trying to change both attitudes and practice. What do we know about the students who are involved and exposed to this program?
We know that every student at UNC has this experience. And as a result of having this experience, we've had more students come to us that are interested in geriatrics, and we have started a specialty concentration at UNC right now for students who are interested in having 4 years of experience with working with the older adult patient.
And Will, you mentioned previously kind of the experience you had when you first came to the community, when we have communities that people are wanting to come here to relocate, and many geriatrics, and the difficulty of finding practitioners. Mm-hmm. I have to expect, Ellen, your real kind of hidden hope is that a lot of these students will either become family doctors and want to take care of geriatrics, or perhaps want to subspecialize into geriatrics.
We'd love that, but we know that there's a very small percentage. So our goal is to, no matter what discipline any of our students go into, except for possibly pediatrics, that they're going to be taking care of older adults. So our goal is to have them understand and do the best possible job they possibly can in whatever field they go into in care of the older adult patient.
And Will, when you're meeting with a new student, you hear them, they get taught a certain way. They're supposed to ask questions. And students frequently come in and they have a certain way of wanting to be seen. And one of the things is should they be wearing a white coat? You know, there's a right order of things. What do you talk to the students about?
Well, again, we meet three or four times during that time. I believe it was said that they could wear their coats when they came for a home visit. It was up to them in the beginning. So I kind of talked to the two, and I said, listen, I hope you don't wear your white coats. The reason why is I live in a townhouse, and we have a lot of elderly people, including myself, that we're friends with. We look after one another. And if my neighbor sees you two coming to my house in white coats, oh, my goodness, they'll think something happened to me. Well, they laughed. And they didn't come with their white coats.
Well, and I imagine coming into the exam room sometimes with a white coat can have the same focus. It'd be powerful, but it also it says that maybe you're sick. And maybe you don't feel sick. What's the advice you give to students that maybe is the advice that all of us need to hear about how we approach people that are older than us to form relationships?
I tried to tell them that when you become a doctor, okay, and you have an elderly patient, or maybe not even an elderly patient, please listen. Listen. I know many doctors over the years that I've seen before I came here, they seem to know it all, and they don't listen to you. That has changed. And also, I know in the medical field, a lot of Latin words. But a lot of us, we never took Latin. Although I took 4 years in high school, and I don't know what happened there. But, you know, use common language with us. You know, we'd really appreciate that. I try to impart that. The last two fellows I had said, well, we want to be orthopedic surgeons. I said, well, old people can break. In fact, I had my accident the
yeah,
second time I met with
you
them.
You just recently tore a tendon in your
right.
knee, but you look pretty good today. That was my great aunt would have said, a blessed memory, don't tell me how I look. Ask me how I feel.
Yeah, exactly.
Ellen, let me ask you as we begin to wrap up, what's the next step that you think we need to go and our training and our geriatric assessment planning to have society able to really offer this type of care to our geriatric populations?
Well, I think it would be really nice if the AAMC...
which is the American Association of Medical Colleges that's responsible for kind of overseeing medical education in the country.
Correct. If it had requirements where we actually had to make sure every medical student completed it. Certain competencies in care of the older adult population, I think that would strengthen our whole nation's learning about care of the, especially the frail older adult population.
I think it's from your mouth to God's ears that would happen. And let me ask you one final question, and which is one of the things I've discovered about geriatrics, it's incredibly gratifying, but on the other hand, it's sometimes difficult because my patients die. I mean, I formed relationships with them, and I wonder how you prepare the students to have maybe some conversations, and because I'm sure they're going to come up at some point in time with some patients who maybe are less well or maybe struggling with some things. What's your advice for students and those that are really working with elderly populations on this issue?
Well, many, many people are elderly, and no matter what field you're in, you're going to come across a senior, and you'll be there someday. And I'm sure you want to treat them the way you want to be treated. And what else can I say? Yeah.
Ellen, what would you say?
I'd say a lot more is being done in the whole area of advanced care planning and palliative care. They're trying to introduce a lot more of that into the medical school and residency curriculum. And I think with communications and comfort care, that's going to help the training of the next generation of providers a lot.
Well, I want to thank both of you, Ellen Roberts and Will Plattner, for a sensitive conversation that allows us to listen and respect and respond and ask questions. It sounds like that's what you're doing in teaching the students is to ask good questions and then listen. And I want to thank both of you for helping us do that and your help listeners do that today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you for inviting the Senior Mentor Program and our mentor on.
We're certainly going to put a link up on our website and see if we can't even get some skydiving interest here. We've been talking with Dr. Ellen Roberts, director of the Senior Mentor Program at the University of North Carolina's Division of Geriatric Medicine, and Will Plattner, a longtime volunteer mentor, about working together to improve the care of an aging population. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering your questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And if any listener would like us to address an issue on an upcoming show, they can send a comment to yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, that's yourhealth@unc.edu. And I'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
So the first listener we have says, I recently had an infected ingrown toenail. I was surprised when my doctor didn't give me antibiotics, but instead said that he could do environmental treatments. I'd never really heard of those, but they all made sense once we talked about them, and I'm curious, do most doctors know about them?
Well, I don't know. That's a great question. We'd have to kind of have that rapid poll
yeah.
of doctors. But I will say, I don't think it's a given. You know, I think a lot of doctors, you know, you hear about an ingrown toenail, comes in, it looks kind of ugly, maybe a little locally infected in the skin. You think, oh, I need to put them on antibiotics.
Right.
But the reality is the problem that's occurring is most often the nail is cut real short. You know, a lot of people think, oh, if I cut my nail shorter, I can kind of get rid of that area. But the problem is the nail kind of starts curving under. Yeah, I know. It's kind of gross, isn't it?
It just sounds painful.
Yeah. And the problem is you need to actually have that nail grow out. You can't try to cut it shorter. So what you have to do, though, is keep the skin off of that nail.
Okay.
So I like to say, well, why don't you soak your foot in warm water for 10 minutes twice a day? And after the skin gets real soft, just kind of gently push it away from the nail. Maybe gently take your fingernail or piece of dental floss and just lift the nail up. Don't break it. Just gently get the pressure off that nail. You could even take a Band-Aid and push it away from the nail.
Okay.
You could take a little piece of cotton and stick it underneath the nail. Anything you do to get the pressure off of it.
Mm-hmm.
Very simple sorts of things that sometimes can really make a big difference. After a week or two, the nail starts to grow out. Some of the pressure on the skin there, that oftentimes is enough. And you may not need antibiotics. And if you do need antibiotics, sometimes just the ointment, a little bacterial ointment with the Band-Aid can sometimes be real helpful. But you got to get the skin away from that nail.
So practical.
Yeah, being practical. We'll call it a toenail practical 101. There. I'm glad this patient's doing better. What's our very next house call, Laura?
I'm 54, and I really believe I'm in menopause because of my hot flashes. I had a hysterectomy 10 years ago, and I thought about taking hormones for my hot flashes since I think it would be pretty safe. I know it's sometimes controversial, and I'm curious about what the current thinking is.
Well, I give you credit for understanding that it could be controversial because, you know, a lot of people think, oh, you know, you have a hysterectomy, you just
go on hormone.
You just go on hormone replacement, right? The problem with hormone replacement is that it has side effects. And if you have a uterus, one of the potential side effects is you're going to increase your risk of uterine cancer. So you have to then take a second drug to shed your uterus. If you smoke, you shouldn't be on the hormone replacement because you have risk of clots. Even if you don't smoke, you might have a higher risk of clots. You might have a slightly higher risk of breast cancer. Ah, but you're balancing out how you deal with the hot flashes, how you maybe help the bones a little bit. So it's been more controversial, particularly if you had a uterus. If you didn't have a uterus, you could say, well, okay, I don't have to worry about that uterine cancer. But you might still have these other things like what happens if you have severe headaches? What if you have high blood pressure? You know, there may be other contraindications, reasons why you wouldn't want to use those for the hot flashes in particular, because maybe there are other drugs you could use, like people call SSRIs, those drugs like Prozac, or SRNIs, these newer drugs, things like Effexor, medicines that could work, or even non-other hormonal treatments. There's a medicine called gabapentin that sometimes works, Neurontin, people know it by. So there are other ways of treating it. You know what it requires?
Tell me.
A long conversation with your doctor.
There you go. Some discussion.
Longer than we probably have time for today. We'd encourage you to talk with your doctor. Great question. answer is probably not as great. What's our next house call, Laura?
My mother recently came to see her family physician because of some dizziness. She has had anxiety for a long time, but I was also shocked to find out that when the doctor asked her about alcohol use, she drinks every day. How can it be that despite being her daughter, I didn't know that she was basically abusing alcohol?
Oh, that's a tough one, isn't
it? Yeah, it really is.
I mean, well, first off, thank goodness that you were there and she allowed you to be there and you went with
her. When she heard it, yeah.
When you could hear all this, right?
Right.
And, yeah, I'm always a fan. Like, you know your loved one is having something going on. Ask, could you, you know, advocate? Could you come in? Could you be there? I think your mother allowing you to be there was a sign that maybe she maybe wanted you to know. And kudos to the doctor for asking that question, right? Not
right.
Every doctor would think, oh, dizziness. They think, oh, you have anxiety. That maybe it's,
right.
That's what's going on there. But not assuming and asking questions, because alcohol abuse is a lot more frequent than people realize.
Yeah. Like you said, it is kind of a show of trust that she was willing to have her daughter in the room. So, you know, she's worried about despite being her daughter, she didn't know this, but there is a real indication of trust there.
And hopefully this is a path towards healing. I mean, there's a lot of shame, not only about substance use, but also mental health. And we don't know when people are suffering or depressed. You knew about the anxiety. So maybe it's not as surprising there. But I think the real question is, what do you do now that you know how to you ensure she continues to get help, and maybe you may need some help too. That's where we have Al-Anon for family members of people who are suffering from substance abuse. So thank you for that very question, and good luck to your mother and to you. What's our very last house call?
Our last listener is a young doctor who says that he or she listens to the show and has for several years now, and I appreciate your thoughtful responses to patients. I've noticed that sometimes I have patients coming in who are taking 5 prescriptions and 7 supplements despite being pretty young themselves. I find it overwhelming sometimes to manage this for them in the time that we have. How do you recommend the patient and physician navigate this issue?
First off, thank you for listening, and
yeah.
Thank you for thinking that we're
yeah.
doing a decent enough job.
That's
we always,
good to
always
hear.
Appreciate that. And believe me, this is a difficult issue. And, you know, we see this with our learners, with our residents, and we're frequently helping them. We call it precepting. And they'll come to us and go, I'm just overwhelmed. You know, I have 20 minutes to see this patient, and they came in, and it took 15 minutes just to get their medication history alone.
Yep.
You know, and you think, you know, first off, what do you do when you're really stressed? You know, the very first recommended advice we give to doctors when they're really stressed?
What is it?
Check their own pulse. Take a deep breath. And just acknowledge, okay, this is difficult, right? This is not easy and straightforward.
Right.
And what I like to say is to let the patient know you've got 20 minutes. Maybe you can stretch it to 30 for this patient. Maybe you could even set it up at a time where they're the last patient. They could be 40 minutes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you need to figure out how to manage time. Share that it's not easy for you. But yet you want to understand both how you can respond, really begin to get it done. You don't have to get all done in one day.
Right.
Or in one visit.
Yeah.
You can take several visits and begin to, I like to call it like an onion. You're peeling a layer away. You're beginning, you know, but by sharing it, perhaps you get to know each other a little bit better and help you understand. You know, you're taking 5 prescriptions, 7 herbal things. You're pretty young. What's this about? Help me understand.
Yeah.
Do you think it's too much? Would you like to get on less? How do we work together?
Great. Yeah.
Can't hurt, I don't think.
I don't think so. I mean, you know, open and honest communication with your physician is always a good thing,
hey,
I think.
Hear, hear. Well, that'll conclude House Calls, and we want to thank all of you today for joining us. We hope we've answered questions that are important to your health. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes, or send us a question to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guests today, Dr. Ellen Roberts and Will Plattner. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.